Hello, I'm Joseph Plantip. This is number 0432, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0432. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Robert J. Hoshowski, who's the author of Outraged, The Murder of Shoeshine Boy Emmanuel Jax, a 1977 sex crime and murder of a 12-year-old boy that still haunts Toronto to this day.
There were actually four men involved. They basically all lived fairly transient lifestyles, and they had been preying on young boys for months prior to Emmanuel's abduction and murder. What happened is one of them in particular, his name is Saul Batesh, he was the ringleader of the group, and he would entice boys back to the apartment above this body rub for sexual purposes.
Actress and model Eugenia Kuzmina has a 2018 calendar that helps to raise money for hurricane relief.
It was really warm. We decided to go to some bars because that's the place, you know, it's kind of a paradise. The water is always warm, and only a week after the hurricane happened. So originally we wanted to show the beauty of nature and support different organizations, you know, for environment. But because of the hurricane, we decided to kind of focus more on the hurricane relief.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and Book Banter gives a golden stopwatch to 60 Minutes with 50 Years of 60 Minutes. So get ready for some golden journalistic moments with Mike, Morley, Dan, Ed, Steve, Leslie, and the rest of the gang later on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0432 was Joseph Planta, who is the host and editor of thecommentary.ca. Check it out. Lots of fun stuff there. That's thecommentary.ca. And thank you very much, Joseph, for doing the guest slate on this program, a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? A rental car insurance company contacted detectives in Stamford, Connecticut, saying that they had information that a rental car stolen from Hertz was reported to be in the city. Sure enough, investigator Richard Vetter found the car and spotted a man getting in to drive it away. Vetter stopped the driver for questioning. 70-year-old Jacques Alouf still had the rental contract in the glove compartment. It showed the car, a 2013 Nissan Altima valued at about $15,000, was rented at the airport in Warwick, Rhode Island nearly 3 years ago at the rate of $792 per week. Alouf was charged with second-degree larceny, but may be able to avoid conviction by paying the contracts weekly, times the number of weeks he had the car, which totals to $25,344. Police released Alouf after he signed a promise to appear in court. Yeah, but like the rental contract, did the promise to appear in court specify when? Authorities say a man angered over people driving dangerously through a busy intersection appeared to intentionally cause a crash there to highlight the problem. 61-year-old Bruce John Homer told Lake County Sheriff's Office deputies who responded to the Sunday afternoon accident that he was frustrated that law enforcement wouldn't crack down on people running through a stop sign at the intersection. The driver of the SUV that was hit says Homer pulled out in front of him as he was going through the intersection. The driver says Homer approached him after the crash, telling him he'd run the stop sign and law enforcement won't do anything until someone dies. Homer is charged with aggravated battery and reckless driving. Well, if Homer goes to jail, he won't have to worry about driving through that intersection anymore, will he? 21-year-old Mako J. Rosado Jr. went on a crime spree in Allentown, Pennsylvania. First, he broke into a restaurant, but the owner lives in an apartment below the eatery and heard the window break. He grabbed a gun and confronted Rosado, but Rosado had his own gun, so the two men agreed to both walk away. Rosado only got away with the restaurant's keepsake first dollar earned that was displayed on a wall. Next, Rosado broke into a house and stole a plant that he thought was marijuana. It was an ordinary houseplant. Shortly after that, a woman confronted Rosado rummaging through her car. When he turned around, he was holding her purse. He fled after pointing his gun at her too, ordering her not to call the police. She did anyway. And he accidentally dropped the gun as he ran from them. He was quickly caught anyway. In a plea bargain, Rosado pleaded guilty to 3 counts of burglary in exchange for 12 other counts being dismissed and was sentenced to 7.5 to 15 years in prison. Well, his plea bargain was an awfully wise decision for a guy that's dumber than the houseplant he tried to steal. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, a Texas woman was busted for mailing homemade explosives to former President Obama and the Lone Star State's governor that could have caused severe burns or death after cat hair linked one of the packages to her. 46-year-old Julia Poff of Houston mailed booby-trapped packages to Obama and Republican Governor Greg Abbott in October of 2016 and sent a third to Social Security Administration Commissioner Carolyn Colvin. Only Abbott opened his, but it didn't explode because he didn't open it as designed. Security screeners intercepted the packages sent to Obama and Colvin. Federal investigators were able to track the devices back to Poff after they found shipping labels, a salad dressing cap used in one of the bombs, and cat hair that traced to one of her cats. She picked the three because she was upset with Abbott because she had not received support from her ex-husband when Abbott was the state's attorney general, did not like the president, and had been denied Social Security benefits. Poff pleaded not guilty to the charges. Okay, if you listen to this show regularly, then you know how I feel about cats. They're evil. Little pieces of evil plotting against mankind. So it's fine for authorities to look into any motives Julia might have had in sending the packages, but I implore the authorities not to drop the furball and overlook the motives of her cats. They're Machiavellian. That's all I'm saying. Keep your eyes open, people. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Robert J. Hachowski is a Canadian crime writer. He's written several books. His latest is Outraged, The Murder of Shoeshine Boy Emmanuel Jacks. He joins us on the line from Toronto. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us once again. This particular crime that took place, it's the murder of a 12-year-old Toronto shoeshine boy. And for those who aren't familiar with it, let's start with the title of your book, because you mentioned Outraged. This was a crime that really shook Toronto.
It really shook Toronto, Peter, and actually there were demonstrations even across Canada because of it. Just to give a little bit of context, what happened, it was in 1977 when this young Portuguese immigrant boy named Emmanuel Jacks was out shining shoes on Yonge Street just to make a few dollars for his family. And Yonge Street at the time had declined to such an extent where it was literally, you know, this once famous street called Yonge Street is Fun Street. It had declined to a state where it was basically porno theaters, illegal body rubs, massage parlors, things along those lines. And once the murder happened, in short, there was such a rebellion against it and the city, demonstrations and much, much anger on the part of citizens and police and politicians, that they demanded the cleanup of the Yonge Street immediately, which happened basically within about a year.
And for those in our international audience who aren't familiar with Yonge Street, it's the hub, the center of Toronto, and the decay that Yonge Street went through at that time period is not necessarily that much different than what Times Square was going through in the early 80s.
Well, interesting you say that, because actually there were comparisons to Times Square and 42nd Street in particular, which in the 70s and 80s indeed had become this area populated by, you know, the adult industry, let's put it politely. And there were fears that Toronto was heading the same way. And the growth of the sex industry on Yonge Street, the illegal sex industry, and we're talking unlicensed body rubs, which would appear and disappear at whim. At one point, there were almost 150 of them in just a stretch of Yonge Street, which was also at the time the most famous street in all of Canada, basically.
Now, as you say, there was outrage at the time, and times have certainly changed. We've gone past a lot of what has taken place in that part of the city and indeed in the country. But does this story still strike a nerve in Toronto?
Oh, very much so. Very much so. As a matter of fact, I actually had the official launch just this week, and people came up to me, and it was pretty emotional, Peter, because a lot of them had actually known Emmanuel, and a lot of them, you know, over a certain age, remembered very well the story, and some of them had been shoeshine boys themselves. And they were quite upset, not at me, but they were actually quite honored that I had done a book paying respect to Emmanuel, and they were quite upset at the fact that the city had allowed Yonge Street to decline to such an extent that a cleanup like this was required.
Now, take us back to 1977, and again, that outrage and the raw feeling that people in Toronto had. This was a brutal murder, and one of the things, I mean, it was just a year after we in this country had gotten rid of the death penalty. People actually wanted it back, right?
People wanted it back, in particular the Portuguese community, within days of the murder. What happened is, first it was a missing persons case, and 4 days later, Emmanuel's body was found not just on Yonge Street, but above a place called Charlie's Angels, which was one of these illegal body rub parlors. Within days, an estimated 15,000 people protested at City Hall, and to look at the photos now, it's stunning. It still shocks me, even though I wrote the book, because you'll see people carrying effigies, life-size dummies, with a noose around their neck. There were people, I don't want to, you know, use the profanity here, but basically saying, you know, effing murderers, kill them all, bring back capital punishment, death is too good for these pigs, signs like that. It was incredible. There were people, you had little kids, 5 years old, all the way up to seniors in their 80s protesting this murder.
Tell us what happened with the case itself, those who were involved.
Sure. There were actually 4 men involved. They basically all lived fairly transient lifestyles, and they had been preying on young boys for months prior to Emmanuel's abduction and murder. What happened is one of them in particular, and it's interesting because the Montreal Gazette did a huge piece on him. His name is Saul Batesh. He's still alive. He's still in the news quite often. He was the ringleader of the group, and he would entice boys back to the apartment above this body rub for sexual purposes. They'd do the old, you know, come with me, I'm going to give you some money to help move something, which is how they lured Emmanuel. They promised $35 an hour to him to move some camera equipment, which was just a complete hoax. So they would lure kids back, they would photograph them in various states of undress, and they would sexually assault them. They had done this to dozens of kids prior to Emmanuel, and tragically, Emmanuel was the one who they decided to actually to murder, not to let go.
Was there any collateral fallout from all of this when it took place back then? The reason why I bring that up is whenever you hear something like this, a crime that takes place that preys on children, and heaven forbid the person who preys on children is same sex, it has a backlash in the gay community.
It was huge. It was actually, I cover that quite extensively in my book. And it was a bit unfair because what happened is, because several of the men were indeed homosexual, the press jumped on that immediately. And the child didn't die right away. The poor kid suffered over 12 hours. So the press, the Toronto Sun in particular, came up with a tag that he had died during a homosexual orgy. And even relatively staid publications like Maclean's picked up on that as well, as did the Globe and Mail, as did the Montreal Gazette, as did the Ottawa Citizen, CBC, CTV. So this went all across Canada and even the United States, because people were obviously quite upset, but the fact is it also set in some people's minds, it set gay rights back quite a few years.
Is part of the problem, too, the fact that it was so graphic and the media did spell it out in a lot of detail? Was that part of the problem, that part of the outrage?
Absolutely. Absolutely right. Because what happened is it was one of basically the first trials in Canadian history as well. This was pre-Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka and Clifford Olson, right? It was one of the first trials in Canadian history where reporters took extreme liberties to cover in graphic detail exactly what happened to him, what happened to other children. They had children testifying, some I believe as young as 10. They didn't use their names in the publication, thankfully, because they were minors, but they did publish details of the ordeals that they suffered. And that was part of the criticism of the media was, you know, you had people in Toronto, supposedly the old adage, Toronto the Good, saying, how dare you print these sort of salacious, disgusting, revolting details about what happened to this young boy? So the press was definitely not immune to criticism itself.
In doing the research, in telling this story so many years later, did you ever stop to think what this would have been like nowadays in our 24-hour news cycle culture and social media?
I did, actually, and I think it would have perhaps not the same horrific effect as it did back in 1977 and during the trial in 1978, but it would definitely have an impact even nowadays, because we're painting this against the backdrop of a street that had declined to such an extent that people either avoided it or basically wanted a lot of these stores, these body rubs closed for good. So I think in today's day and age, you know, there's so many facets to this story that it would cause maybe not the same outrage, but it would cause a great deal of upset even in the digital age.
Does your book bring the players of this situation up to date? I mean, obviously, Emmanuel is no longer with us, but he had family. The perpetrators went off to prison. Do we have any updates as to what happened to those who involved, or even the police officers who were involved in the case?
The key officers, actually, they passed away, unfortunately. One of the attorneys passed away. I interviewed several of the attorneys for the four. There were four individuals involved, and one was found not guilty. And to my knowledge, the last known sighting of him was around 2004. He's a homeless individual. The one who I mentioned earlier, a few moments ago, Saul Batesh, is in the news constantly. He's actually never left the media. And the reasons being is that he's, in the words of corrections officers, a continual pain in the ass. And by that, he's staged numerous hunger strikes over the years. He wanted to run for counsel from behind bars when he was incarcerated in Kingston Penitentiary. He went on a hunger strike claiming that he was not receiving kosher food. He was in the press about 5 years ago on an online prison meet and greet site. And part of the outrage of that, Peter, was that he said that his conviction was assault. So you had others on the website saying, you know, yeah, I murdered my wife, I murdered my husband, and he was still lying and unapologetic. And as recently as February of this year, he was on another prison dating site looking for potential mates and pen pals.
I know you write about true crime a lot, and I'm just wondering your personal thoughts on this. And I bring this up only because just recently, of course, in the United States, you had the death of Charles Manson, and I've always maintained that one of the things that fascinated me about Charles Manson, and fascinating is not the right word, I guess, but the idea that he was still in the news, and one of the things that always bothered me about him was the fact that he was always breaking the rules. For instance, he was sneaking in cell phones into his cell when he was still incarcerated, and in my mind, I kept thinking, for the heinous crimes that he did, and I'm not one for the death penalty, I figure you rot in jail forever, but he shouldn't even know what a cell phone is.
Exactly. Exactly right. And I mean, in the case of Manson, that was an issue. In the case of Clifford Olson, you may recall that a number of years ago, prior to his death, he was actually tormenting family members of the children he killed via fax. This is back in the 1990s. And you ask yourself, okay, first of all, this person should be grateful that he's even alive, you know, as Canada no longer has capital punishment. But the second part is, why would someone like this have access to a fax machine in the first place? Just as Manson, why would he have access to a cell phone? And why would he be able to have access to information such as the phone numbers and fax numbers of the parents of the kids he killed?
I bring this up only because, again, I'm asking the question to you, how do you feel about, you know, this perpetrator being, as you mentioned, the correctional facilities are saying, a constant pain in the ass? And in the news.
One of the questions I've received is, you know, did I reach out to him? And I did not, actually. Even though I know people who knew him and who could get me contact. And the reason for that being is I've given him, I feel, enough of a form. I wanted the focus of the book to be Emmanuel and how his murder, as tragic as it was, definitely changed the face of Toronto for the betterment of the whole city. There's so much about Saul Bitesh and the other individuals that I think that it was just enough to cover them in the book. You know, their crimes are noted in detail. But the book's focus primarily is on Emmanuel and how his tragic death helped the city.
The book is called Outrage, The Murder of Shoeshine Boy Emmanuel Jacks. Robert, I thank you once again for being on the program with us.
Well, thank you very much, Peter. I appreciate it.
Robert J. Hachowski, author of Outraged, The Murder of Shoeshine Boy Emmanuel Jacks. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0432, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like, but the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, coming to you from Montreal, Canada, where we share the longest unprotected border in the world with the United States. Take that as a sign of extreme friendship or a warning.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to actress, model, and stand-up comic Eugenia Kuzmina, who has a 2018 calendar coming out that you might want to take a look at. Adults only. Stuart Nullman will be along with another edition of Book Banter. We do have an Idiot of the Day coming your way and lots more Stuff File news here on a program that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make the show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get back to the stuff. An Illinois woman was busted this week after cops say she torched her Infiniti SUV with a flamethrower that she purchased online. 47-year-old Julie Gagne of Barrington was charged with arson, disorderly conduct, and filing a false police report. She reported her 2016 Infiniti QX70 stolen on November the 10th after the fire. She was at a restaurant and she called to say that her car was missing when she came out of the restaurant, according to Schaumburg Deputy Police Chief Dan Roach. Firefighters found the vehicle ablaze at the end of a dead-end street in Barrington near a precious metal refinery. Gagne later retracted the report that her car was stolen. Gagne turned herself into police. She was released on a personal recognizance bond after a court appearance. Police haven't determined a motive. Barrington Police Chief David Dorn said an X-15 flamethrower was found near the SUV after the fire was extinguished. X-Matter in Ohio manufactures the flamethrower, which is legal in Illinois. An investigation determined Gagne bought the flamethrower online. The flamethrower in question uses a mix of about 3 gallons of fuel and napalm to throw flames as far as 50 feet. The device goes for about $1,600. X-Matter says controlled burns for agricultural purposes, weed incineration, and pyrotechnic events are among the typical uses for the company's flamethrowers. Apparently nowhere in its documentation is it suggested that someone use it for torching their own car. And in case simply eating fried chicken isn't enough for KFC fans in Japan, Twitter users there have an opportunity to luxuriate in the essence of one of 100 KFC bath bombs. That's bath salts infused with the fast food giant's signature 11 herbs and spices. KFC tells UPI that the limited edition bath bombs won't be sold in stores, but people who retweet the chain's promotional post will be entered to win one. Okay, is there anybody out there right now listening to this who has a desire to be finger-licking good? Let that thought sink in like a long, hot bath. A thief stole an SUV belonging to the Fort Worth Fire Department at the scene of a house fire in Fort Worth early Thursday and then crashed it into gas pumps at a nearby 7-Eleven. While firefighters were extinguishing the blaze in northwest Fort Worth, a thief jumped into the battalion chief's SUV and drove off, according to fire department spokesman Kyle Clay. Soon afterward, he crashed into the gas pumps at a 7-Eleven under construction and was arrested just south of there. He was out there screaming that his wife was inside the house, Clay said of the man, identified as 47-year-old Robert Kelsall. Kelsall directed firefighters to a window and then wandered over to the battalion chief's SUV, hopped in, and took off. Turns out he didn't live in the house, and there was nobody inside. The owner was not around. After he plowed into the gas pumps at the 7-Eleven, Kelsall got out of the SUV and fled. Callers reporting a suspicious person in the neighborhood alerted police to his whereabouts, and he was arrested. He faces charges of vehicle theft, interfering with public duties, and public intoxication. That's a whole new level of chutzpah, don't you think? Whole new level. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, tempers flared in Minot, North Dakota, before 33-year-old Cornelius Marcel Young was charged with terrorizing after attacking his fiancée's brother at a trailer park on November the 3rd. Young yelled at the brother, punched him in the face, and knocked him down and into a wall after he had turned up the thermostat in the trailer, according to the Minot Municipal Court affidavit. When the brother threatened to call police, Young brandished a knife as his fiancée jumped on his back and bit his ear to distract him. Two children were in the trailer during the fight, but they were uninjured. You know, quite frankly, I'm surprised there aren't more violent altercations between people and even couples when it comes to where a home's thermostat is set at. I also think when it comes to premarital counseling, a median temperature value for the couple involved has to be determined before people are allowed to say, I do. I'm just saying. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? International model, actress, and comedian Eugenia Kuzmina is the subject of a new 2018 calendar photographed by Antoine Verglas. The world-renowned fashion photographer shot Kuzmina on the Caribbean island of St. Barts. Kuzmina in the shots is wearing nothing but a smile and plenty of sand. A portion of the proceeds of the calendar sales will benefit hurricane relief both in the U.S. and abroad. Joining us on the line right now is Eugenia Kuzmina. She's in New York City. Hi, Eugenia.
Hi. I'm actually in the Empire State Building. It's the holiday season, so some time off. I'm great. It's great to be with you guys.
Thanks for being on the program with us. I've had an opportunity to see the calendar, and it's very beautiful, very tastefully done, but I know a lot of time goes into getting that perfect shot, or in this case, 12 perfect shots for a calendar. What's it like for you as a model to be in a shoot like that? It can't be as comfortable as it looks.
Well, you know, I have to say thank you to an amazing photographer, Antoine Verglas, because he's been photographing, you know, amazing, incredible models, top models, celebrities, and first ladies for a century. And he just knows how to make a picture look good. So actually, you know, I didn't have to do much. I just have to be there and kind of, you know, work around him. It was really warm. We decided to go to some bars because that's a place, you know, it's kind of a paradise. The water is always warm, and only a week after the hurricane happened. So eventually, like, originally, we wanted to show the beauty of nature and support different organizations, you know, for environment. But because of the hurricane, we decided to kind of focus more on the hurricane relief.
Well, I was about to ask, how did you come to this particular project in the first place? As you just said, it wasn't necessarily attached to hurricane relief in the beginning.
You know, my dad was a nuclear scientist in Russia. He was always very supportive of ecology. He had to work for the government, unfortunately, in that time. But I grew up learning a lot about, you know, the climate and different ways to support ecology. So it was always a big part of my life. And then when I started modeling, you know, at this point, I don't really need to work per se for money. And, you know, I actually was inspired to give back in some ways. And I thought, why can't we bring our skills together with amazing, you know, with this photographer, Antoine, and then a makeup artist, Donna Fumoso, who is incredible, and give back in some ways. You know, we can do something beautiful, create a beautiful product, and, you know, kind of do it for a good cause. So I feel good about giving back.
You mentioned when you started modeling. You actually started modeling when you were 13, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
Yes, that's correct. I wasn't really a good kid in school. I wasn't, you know, sitting at my desk properly all the time. So I think it was a good distraction, and it was a good way to kind of release my creativity is to start modeling. And I always wanted to travel.
So, but besides the fact that you were a well-renowned model, you've also branched into acting. There's a discipline. There's a discipline in both worlds. How do you find the two worlds coalesce together, and how do you find that they're different, the modeling and acting?
You know, I think they're completely different, and that's what a lot of models don't understand when you kind of transition to acting, because modeling is all about, you know, self-awareness, and it's kind of like a dance. You know, you have to know how to move your body and where to position it. You do play a character, but it's a very different skill. While acting, you just can't be aware of yourself. You know, there are different characters, you know, with you, so you have to put your focus on another person. And besides, you know, after modeling, you kind of get spoiled traveling around, and, you know, you have so much attention on you. While acting, you, if you're a good actor, I think you have to, you know, be a developed human being. I think, you know, every good actor I love, they're incredible people. So it was a big transition for me.
It is a transition from modeling, and I'm just kind of curious. You said you weren't the greatest of students when you were a girl, a young girl, so you went into modeling. When you first started modeling, where did you see your life leading to, and are you where you thought you would be when you first started modeling, or is it an entirely different transition for you?
No, absolutely not. You know, I started acting after I had my kids, so it's not like a normal way to go, you know, to plan a career after you have two kids, and, you know, you're in your, like, late 20s. But, you know, just kind of, I take opportunities whenever I can. I think I grew up in Russia, and, you know, I always wanted to take the most out of life, to live it to the fullest. So you never know. I'm open to things switching on the way and being in the moment, and I always knew that I will be working in a creative field. That's the only thing that, you know, I was looking for as an artist. I felt like I, you know, need to find a way to express myself in the post-Soviet times, where a lot of, you know, poets and artists were oppressed. Even though my dad was a nuclear scientist, we always grew up around painters and, you know, the whole creativity, which was not available for us. So I always was looking for a way to, you know, to express it or to find the right avenue, and modeling and acting were amazing.
Well, let's, going back to the calendar, let's talk about the creative process of that calendar. As I said in the introduction, you're wearing nothing but a smile and plenty of sand. What's the process like between you and the photographer? Do you know when you, even before you get to St. Bart's, the ideas as to what those the photo shoot is going to be like? Is it a collaborative situation between you and the cameraman, or is he just really the director and you are sort of like, in, for lack of a better term, the clay to his modeling kind of thing?
No, it's absolutely a collaborative process. You know, I always believe it has to be. There has to be a connection. And, you know, especially if you shoot a project like that, you have to be comfortable because you're not wearing any clothes. And I knew that Antoine is just, I could trust him. You know, he's a good friend. We talked about it for a while and why we're doing it. We're trying to portray, you know, what kind of feeling So it's absolutely a collaborative thing. And also, I think it's very different. In Europe, we look at the human, the woman's body, and we don't see specifically it's all about, like, you know, sex or something like that. I feel in America, it's a kind of a different thing. So I feel, for me, it was all about nature and kind of how the human body fits into the nature. And I felt if I would be wearing some clothes, it would be just, you know, about the clothes. It wouldn't be about a person and, you know, nature around it. So I felt completely comfortable with that. And, you know, I felt really good with it. I'm really happy with the results.
And as I mentioned, the proceeds, some of the proceeds from the calendar will help hurricane relief, both in the U.S. and abroad. I understand that people can go to a couple of websites. One is thepeacefund.org. And the other is Fonzkoze, that's FONKOZE.org, correct?
Yeah, and, you know, I took my time to choose organizations that I know personally. It was really important for me. The Peace Fund is organized by Adrian Poole. He's an amazing actor from Highlander. And we know each other for a while now. We, you know, participated in a few charities together, and I just can see that his work really, his word stands for his work, you know, and he really delivers. He supports underprivileged charities, which is small, and that donate, you know, 100% to the needed. And the same with Fonzkoze, they're supporting Haiti, and they are donating 100% of the proceeds to the cause. And I know, you know, they're the organizer. Like, for me, it was very important to have charities that I trust and that will deliver.
Well, it is a very beautiful calendar, to say the least, and you have been very, very busy, what with your modeling and your acting. What's coming up next for you?
I was featured in the film Isn't It Romantic, which is amazing. It's a film by Todd Strauss-Schulzen with Rebel Wilson and Priyanka Chopra and Chris Hemsworth, and it was a blast, actually, to shoot in New York. You know, amazing director, completely different experience. It was super fun. It's a comedy, so I'm really looking forward for everybody to see that. I also have a lot of shows at the Comedy Store that's coming up. The next one is December 1st. It's a lot of fun to do live stand-up shows, and I'm planning to go more on the road next year. And also I'm doing a few films with Televisa in South America, which are action films. So it's busy, yeah.
What do you, is there a favorite thing you like to do? Like I said, you're doing quite a bit, especially in the acting world, you're doing quite a bit, various genres. Do you like the action or the comedy or the drama more, or do you just like it all?
You know, for me, the most honest way to communicate is stand-up. I love it because you have no safety net and you never know who will come to see you. So, you know, if people laugh, it's because, you know, they laugh. And what I found out is, like, it's not about the jokes, it's about the truth. And for me, and I think for everybody, it's so healing, especially nowadays. We all need laughter, and it's really exciting just to be on that stage and connect to people and, you know, bring, like, a special energy and share the truth. You know, and that's one of my favorite things, just going and connecting to strangers that I never met before.
Well, as I said, the calendar is very beautiful, and people can check it out by going to Amazon.com if they want to buy the calendar. And again, a portion of the proceeds will benefit hurricane relief. I thank you very, very much, Eugenia, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you so much.
Actress and model Eugenia Kuzmina. Again, her 2018 calendar is available through Amazon.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0432, and you'll find links to Eugenia's site. You'll also find the two links to hurricane relief that we mentioned earlier. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Who would ever think that a lawsuit involving ice cream could give us a lesson on why filing a lawsuit isn't always such a good idea? But it did, and here's the story. In the 1960s, a premium ice cream maker developed a unique marketing theme based on its Scandinavian-sounding name. 2 decades later, when another ice cream maker also started doing business under a Scandinavian name, the first company sued to force it to change its name. When the case finally made it to court, however, the New York-based creators of the first Scandinavian-sounding company admitted that their own name was actually made up and had no meaning in any language. Meanwhile,
Even though the second company was also based in the United States, its name was taken from a real Swedish phrase meaning frozen joy. Let's be fair, after these marketing secrets were revealed in court, the judge quickly put a deep freeze on the lawsuit. He said that since the first company didn't even have a real connection to Scandinavia, the lawsuit had no merit. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nauman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And with us once again is indeed Stuart Nauman. And what's that? Do I hear ticking in the background? What is that?
Well, it's not my pacemaker because I don't have one. No, it's a stopwatch. And a golden one at that, because in this edition of Book Banter, we're going to look at a golden anniversary for a very major, stellar news magazine show. Because, you know, it was at 10 p.m. on the evening of Tuesday, September 24th, 1968, that Harry Reasoner welcomed viewers to a new show called 60 Minutes, which he proclaimed as, and I quote, a kind of magazine for television. Now, this new venture in TV news was the brainchild of Don Hewitt, the ambitious, colorful executive producer who cut his teeth with such legendary news shows as See It Now with Edward R. Murrow and the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite, which he served as its executive producer. And actually, it was more like the 60 Minutes at the offset was more like a project to keep Hewitt busy after he was literally kicked upstairs in 1965 from his position as executive producer of the evening news by then CBS News president Fred Friendly. Now, this year marks the 50th anniversary and the 50th anniversary season of this magazine for television, and its cover has never closed. Thanks to the reporting and storytelling expertise of its stable of seasoned correspondents, 60 Minutes has set the standards to the golden level of how a TV news magazine should be run. Whether it was a revealing celebrity profile, an exclusive interview with a headline-making newsmaker, an expose of wrongdoing, complete with the hidden camera footage and the ambush-style interview, a breaking story, a news story with plenty of hidden angles, or a slice-of-life story that not many viewers were aware of. And many people thought it was an honor, or maybe a burden, to be a subject of a 60 Minutes piece. And millions of people have practically made it their Sunday nights at 7 viewing habit for just as long as the show's been on the air. Now, to mark 60 Minutes' golden anniversary, Jeff Fager, the show's current executive producer, has completed a lavishly illustrated book filled with plenty of highlights, behind-the-scenes stories, and controversies that are just as intriguing and fascinating as what is presented on the broadcast every week. And it's called 50 Years of 60 Minutes.
I have to say right off the bat that one of the things that 60 Minutes is very lucky about is that they found someone like Jeff Fager who could carry the baton from Don Hewitt and keep the show going much in the same path or direction that it had been going for most of its 50 years.
Oh, exactly. But without the shouting matches with his correspondents when they come to edit the pieces, of course. But I'm not as mercurial as Don Hewitt was, actually. But yes, he did. He has kept those standards high.
Yeah, but I think some of those shouting matches have to do with the extremely strong personalities that were both Don Hewitt and his reporters. I don't know if the current crop, while they're excellent journalists, are willing to fight tooth and nail, not only with Don Hewitt, but with each other for stories.
I mean, the original stable correspondents were from the old school of TV news. You have to admit that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, this book by Fager is a season-by-season, decade-by-decade look back at how 60 Minutes became one of the most influential broadcasts in TV news that somehow managed to get high ratings for more than 40 of its 50 years. Now, Fager does that by recounting some of the show's greatest and not-so-greatest journalistic moments, many of which the reader, who is a regular 60 Minutes viewer like myself since 1975, we'll finally recall watching when these mentioned pieces were first aired. Like one of my favorites, Morley Safer's nostalgic look at the Orient Express Railway as he embarked on its final voyage. Mike Wallace's expose of the fraudulent Marietta health spa. Dan Rather, you'll like this one, Peter, when he donned Afghan garb as he went undercover with Afghan rebels during the early years of the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan.
Oh, of course, you mean Gunga Dan.
Gunga Dan. Didn't fool anybody. And Mike Wallace's exclusive interview with Iranian leader Ayatollah Khomeini at the offset of the 1979-1980 hostage crisis, in which he delicately asked him the question about what he thought about Egyptian President Anwar Sadat calling him a lunatic. And the list just goes on and on. And add to a sense of balance, Fager offers plenty of behind-the-camera stories of what goes on as these stories are being put together, whether it be on the field or in the hectic atmosphere of the 60 Minutes office in New York. I mean, you will get to witness those fiery weekly shouting matches that went on between Mike Wallace and Don Hewitt as they went through the post-production vetting of the former's pieces that were set to air, actually. Even when he gave Andy Rooney, a second chance when his first few minutes piece bombed, and, you know, he could have, like, fired him right there, but Hewitt gave him a second chance.
Remember those early point-counterpoint segments that used to be on the show?
Oh, yeah, Jack Kilpatrick and Shane Alexander, which, you know, I mean, they were great to watch, but it became part of legend thanks to Saturday Night Live.
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, definitely. Now, 50 Years of 60 Minutes is a wonderful appreciation of a show that had no hope of surviving its first season in 1968, and has now become one of the longest-running shows on television that has set high standards in the annals of broadcast journalism, where the emphasis is not only on the facts, but also telling a good story with a great deal of quality and integrity. And after reading this book, you can certainly admit that 60 Minutes has earned its golden stopwatch, and I hope it never stops ticking.
It also became something that's very rare for television news. It became profitable.
Yes. And, you know, news shows weren't supposed to be.
Yep.
Absolutely. They weren't supposed to get, you know, ratings equal to a primetime sitcom or drama. And it has.
Yeah, for many years it was the number one show.
Yeah, exactly. And it really started when Dan Rather joined the crew in 75.
Gunga Dan.
Yeah, Gunga Dan. That you got it.
So the book is entitled
50 Years of 60 Minutes by Jeff Fager. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it's $47.
And what do you suggest in a similar genre or vein?
Well, I recommend three memoirs by three former 60 Minutes figures. First of all, in chronological order, Mike Wallace's massive 1984 memoir, Close Encounters. Then Morley Safer wrote a memoir in 1990 called Flashbacks, focusing on his years as a war correspondent for CBS News during the Vietnam War, and how he revisits some of the sites that he encountered in Vietnam about 25 years after he was on the field, and Don Hewitt's memoir called Tell Me a Story.
Excellent choices indeed. Also, a couple of other books out there, Reflections of a Bloodshot Eye.
Oh, yeah, by Robert Metz.
Is another good book, and CBS Primetime Bad Times.
Ed Joyce's
Ed Joyce's book is brilliant. I love that one.
Yeah, and look, and it was put this way. This is like Tiffany reading from the Tiffany Network.
Absolutely, absolutely. So the book again is
called 50 Years of 60 Minutes by Jeff Fager. It's published by Simon & Schuster, which is also CBS is part of that division, and it's $47.
Excellent. And how can people find you, sir?
Well, you won't see me arguing with Jeff Fager in the corridors of 60 Minutes in New York. You'll see me every week in print in the Montreal Times or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stu.
And yeah, this review and much more on 60 Minutes. The Stuff File program.
Stuart Nullman with another edition of the Stuff File program, or actually Book Banter on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about into the home stretch here on this edition of the Stuff File program. And since we were talking about books with Stuart a moment ago, I want to mention one more book. Mine. Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. You know, you can purchase my book, which, like the title says, features great conversations with the likes of Oscar winners like Carl Malden, Cloris Leachman, and Christopher Plummer, Emmy winners like Ed Asner, Michael Moriarty, and Lindsay Wagner, Tony winners like Carol Channing and Julie Newmar, and a host of TV icons like Buddy Ebsen, Bob Denver, Dick Van Patten, Gary Coleman, and more, plus two guys who left their footprints up on the moon. Check it out. It's available on Amazon.com and Amazon.ca, as well as at my publisher's website, which is BearManorMedia.com. And you'll find the links for the book on the website at thestufffile.com. So buy the book. It's a great Christmas gift. What are you waiting for? Yes. And let's get back to the stuff here on a program that is also listener-supported, fan-funded radio that needs you for our success. So join us at patreon.com and help make this an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, Stelianos Sarodakis told police and reporters he'd been clotheslined by barbed wire strung across a mountain bike trail near Bragg Creek in Alberta. He set up an online campaign asking for donations for a new bike, medical bills, and automated trail cameras to make the area trails safer. But GoFundMe froze his account after local bikers raised questions about his claims. After the RCMP investigated, prosecutors filed fraud charges against him. After he missed his court date, posts appeared on Sarodakis' social media accounts claiming he'd fled to Germany and saying he'll never return to Canada. "We are not confirmed whether or not he did leave the country," said RCMP Colonel, or Corporal rather, Curtis Peters. "But if he did, good riddance. Will police track him down?" "God no," Peters says. "We're better off without that expense, so no, we don't care." Sarodakis was contacted on Facebook but refused to confirm his whereabouts. "I might be living in your backyard. I might be your neighbor. I might be on the other side of the world," he said. "Only God can judge me." And, apparently, only God cares. Meanwhile, police say Andre Young entered a gas station in Fort Park, Ohio, took out a box cutter, and said to the clerk, "We can do this the easy way or the hard way." The clerk did not make it easy. Young, who was 52, allegedly attempted to jump the counter but was defeated with a shove by the man behind it, who then came around and knocked out the not-so-young Young with a single punch to the face. Police say Young, who apparently has served prison time for robbing the same store before, offered his defense. The box cutter was for getting something off of his shirt, and as for trying to get over the counter with it, "Man, I was drunk," he said. The judge had no sympathy for his beating injuries and ordered Young held on a high cash bail. So, it will be the prosecutors proposing a plea and asking him at that time, the easy way or the hard way? And a teenager in Oklahoma was injured while trying to prank his friend. The teenager in Tulsa was rushed to a hospital after he tried to pull the prank on his co-worker by scaring him after he returned from work. It all started when the 18-year-old co-worker hid under his friend's car outside a Brahms restaurant. The friend left the fast food restaurant, got into his vehicle without knowing that the teenager was under the car. The prankster did not act fast enough. As his friend began driving away, he ran over the teenager. Police said that the 18-year-old man was taken to a nearby hospital with head and leg injuries. Yeah, that's one hell of a joke. Nice going there, Sparky. You share with your parents the deets of your hysterical hijinks? They must be proud. You know, I was almost tempted to make this clown the idiot of the day, but I didn't. I figured, no, why bother? But this is the moment you've all been waiting for, boys and girls. Yes, it's time once again for the idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the idiot of the day.
A dealer with zero intelligence has been caught after advertising the drug for sale on Facebook. The would-be entrepreneur posted a picture of cannabis on a Facebook page called Portsmouth Cannabis to try to sell it. But the image was spotted by officers who quickly identified the location using evidence from the photo. After the cannabis was seized, Detective Superintendent Paul Barton, head of Serious and Organized Crimes in Hampshire Police, replied to the post. He said, 10 for 10 for entrepreneurial skills, 0 for 10 for intelligence. Police from the Cosham neighborhood team, Portsmouth, Hampshire, posted on Twitter, advertise the sale of cannabis on social media and expect a knock-knock from us. Team Cosham removing drugs off of our streets. The Portsmouth Cannabis page also links to an Instagram page, which has more than 1,160 followers. Sergeant Rob Sutton from the neighborhood team said, a guy was documenting his cannabis grow and effectively running a blog on how to do it. Using photos he put online, police were able to identify the location by using the roof line in the background. On entering the house, the plants had already been harvested, but a lot of the cannabis was located inside. So, the cops had it right when they mentioned zero intelligence. Because why, oh why, would you advertise your illegal cannabis business on Facebook? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0432. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0432. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, GDPR Evolution 99, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes, streaming on Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Let me leave you with these words of wisdom. Never, ever juggle ice picks while standing on your waterbed.